If you want to advocate something new, you very often simply pick up something in the remote past and cause it to be re-evaluated and say, look, what Confucius was really a reformer.
That, of course, gets into modern times, because, of course, the arch-exponent of this was Kang Youle at the very end of the 19th century, who was indeed, in his own way, revolutionary, who was trying to, in Confucius as a reformer, which is actually Mr. Yes, Sir's
yeah.
title,
yeah.
was trying to get at Confucian Prisca that were lurking hidden in the text,
yeah,
which he
yeah,
grotesquely yeah. misinterpreted. And in fact,
I don't mind whether he misinterpreted them or not, but
well,
the fact
well,
he
interpreted
them.
Well, no, in fact he did, and the man was actually far madder. This is one of the deeply kept secrets of modern Chinese political, this is political thought, but Kang Youle, K-A-N-G-Y-O-U-W-E-I.
Associated with 1898.
Not Y, W-E-I. He was actually mad, and the people, the conservatives were shocked by him.
There are other views of this book, aren't there?
I mean, I was actually totally startled myself. Virtually nobody ever reads it in the original. When I did, it's difficult. I was totally startled at the utter irresponsibility of what was going on. I'm quite serious.
Irresponsibility strikes me as a very
great
thing at the time.
In due course, but leave it. But I don't think there's any clear example of sort of radical Priscanization until Kant. And I may be wrong on that.
Well,
one man
innovates on the basis that I am a true Confucian.
The
Jiangxi does the same thing as well.
Yeah, but the difference is that the doctrine of the sage has to be hidden and then rediscovered.
Mm.
That's the crux, that's the difference.
To make it Prisca Sapientis.
Yeah, that's the point. Just going back to the old authorities, or what are deemed such, is of course routine in China all the way through.
Mm.
But saying there was a hidden message of the sages, and I've got the key.
Oh, yeah. I see what you mean. Yes, yes, it's exactly. Well, that would be the sort of thing that you've got in the Eastern Han again with the Chan Wei books, which is not
probably right.
The people writing the things.
Yeah,
we know people used to say, go off
and
write me another one of those.
Actually, you're quite
producing.
Right about that. Yeah, okay. It then revived with a vengeance later. You're right about that.
Size the country does to
he's got to the point almost of stagnation, not of slow growth, but of stagnant per capita growth. Mm. I mean, if you want some rise, and not 1% per annum, but just a 0.2 will do it.
Oh,
it
would
be very nice, wouldn't it? You could have got that from foreign trade. I mean, that's my hypothesis.
Well,
here.
I think the problem, the kind of markets you might get in India, which had its own cotton trade anyhow, would have been just not worth going
yes.
for.
We're talking only about a share of the market that you're going to get anyhow.
But I mean, whatever that share is, I mean, after all, I mean, they did import raw cotton from India into South China in quite large quantities. I forgot the exact amount, but basically imported about as much as Britain did until just before the turn of the 19th century. I mean, that I can't do more than give you this sort of answer because I'd have to think about it more. I mean, one does keep asking this question, I did at the very beginning. Why not foreign trade is the classical way out? And the answer to techniques, but vast quantities of it. So, I mean, they must have been shipped in very large. Coldrake's way of the carpenter might give some, or maybe his architecture authority in Japan, must give some insight to how they move these quantities of material. Bill Coldrake, W. Coldrake.
And people don't move at any speed. See, horses and wheels to move at speed as a person, don't you?
C-O-A-L. Coldrake. Bill by William Coldrake. There's two books. Where the Carver and Japanese Tools. Coldrake. As in Fadrick. Japanese Tools, Where the Carpenter and Architecture and Authority. Both.
The Egyptians didn't need to use wheels for their stone transport.
Yes, probably. Or
roads. So you can build if you can build a pyramid, you can build a Japanese castle without wheels.
You don't plough for rice.
Well, you can.
You can, but you don't need to use wheel plows.
No.
But that's another extraordinary thing. I mean, I always was told that the evolution of mankind was from the hoe to the plough, but the evolution in Japan is from the plough to the hoe.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of ploughing, with a certain amount of animal ploughing, in the 17th century, by the 19th century.
A yield. I mean, in the poorest parts of France, that's what the peasants do. It's called spade husbandry.
Yes.
And you get higher yields with spade than you do with plough husbandry.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm. So, there's sort of agricultural and all these other kinds of involution.
Does anyone in Japan talk about this?
Yes.
That'd be the interesting thing, wouldn't it? What do they say? I mean, in historically in Japan.
The history department in August.
Yes.
No, I did.
And three economic historians there musing over this question of the disappearance of the wheel, which they agreed with. It had disappeared.
I don't mean modern historians. I mean, are there any people who say things like, strangely enough, our ancestors had a fetish about the wheel. God knows why. We managed perfectly well without it today. Or something. Does anyone in pre-modern Japan discuss these technical issues and give us at least their own point of view on it? No?
What do these gentlemen historians say?
We Japanese are not very good with round things.
This was their three leading experts, friends of Karu's, who had especially got in with the leading Japanese.
That
was their There are two replies. Their reply as to why they didn't use wheels was they're not very good with round things. And their reply as to why they didn't have many water mills. Oh, there's not enough water in Japan.
What?
I mean, actually, there's the British Railways thing. It's not the right kind.
The wrong kind.
The water in Japan tumbles a great rate downhill. It doesn't produce large rivers.
Given him any reason to think in those sort of terms about biology? I'm trying to think of, you know, what religious views of biology are like to be in the 19th century. I'm thinking in terms of great chains of being still and filling up all the possible variations and spaces. I suppose the notion of trying to evaluate all the possible niches that there might be might lead you into thinking in terms of, you know, there are a number of factors, A, B, and C, and D, which gets a little digital rather than to be smooth.
I'm picking up some other thing. I think in the actual article, which is very obscure in some kind of Basel yearbook, it's just it's a very scientific piece without any conjecturing.
Oh yes, I'm not suggesting we conceive, but I'm talking about the context of his discovery. What might have made him think about peas just in the sense of this is a rather better pea or a rather taller or shorter pea than that one?
He's an inquisitive gardener, beekeeper. Who is very interested in these sorts of things. I can't offer more than that.
What was different about it? I mean, there's in the museum in Tokyo, there's a collection of thousands and thousands of drawings of mulberry leaves and of silk cocoons and of larvae or grubs, which an 18th century Japanese person who was trying to improve the silk production in Japan or on his estate was doing, and he looked very carefully, he drew all these things and he went through and classified all these different sizes, and he did quite a lot of selective breeding and found that if he did it this way then he got better and better silk. So he was observing minutely, he was testing, he was experimenting, he was classifying and producing better silk. What
so
is different from
the Japanese Mendel, who Mendel disappeared into the in the archives of a little local natural history society, didn't he? And then was rediscovered afterwards. It could be that there are many different Mendels.
Many mutant glorious Mendels
in
the
copy.
You need characteristics and issues switch on and switch off. With Mendel, wasn't somebody to be whether it was a dwarf variety or not? What was the thing that he was concentrating on? What was he observing?
Tall and short varieties.
That was it. So, yeah, it was sort of either it was tall or it was short. It wasn't that there was one a bit bigger than another. It was dwarfism. Clonk. There's a dwarf pea.
He didn't do colours as well.
I don't know.
But just size.
But there were characteristics, I think, which are very much on-off characteristics produced. Suddenly, there's a dwarf. What characteristics do you require to get the dwarf from the parents? And so where do the dwarfs have to be in the parentage? Because if it's just a silkworm which is a bit better at producing silk, that's not the sort of the same on-off sort of thing, is it?
It's not binary.
Yeah.
No. Not digital. But the story, I mean, the mythical story you could tell of that is a famous one. Basically, it comes from textiles. The sequence, I'm inventing this, but I hadn't seen the connection with Mendel, but you could, Rob probably knows the story. Jacquard's loom, first programmable loom, where you have cards with digital holes. Either there's a hole or there isn't a hole. And so you can drive looms like that. And in the 1820s, Babbage is wandering past some textile factory sheds in London, and he sees a jacquard's loom, and he sees this digital on-off sequence, and he thinks, perhaps this is the key. This is how you could make a machine which could store information as you're storing the jacquard loom, and then release it later, so I could make a calculating machine that did this.
Mm.
And I could therefore make a programmable computer. And in the 1830s, Babbage writes his ninth Bridgewater Treatise, which is read by two people who are wondering how you could get around the 18th century problem of having an evolution of species and yet no miracles, no God intervening to change them, suddenly change the laws. So you've got there seems to be a paradox. How can you have an original creator who doesn't interfere later, and yet an evolution of species? And the first guy who brings out his book in 1844, Robert Chambers' Investitures of Natural Creation, has a whole chapter on Babbage, the ninth Bridgewater Treatise, where he says Babbage solved the problem. What God did, he was the divine, he doesn't use the word, obviously, computer programmer. What he did was at the beginning, he put in tricks so that, as with Babbage's machines, you go along for a very long time with fish, and then suddenly God's program snaps out of fish into reptiles, and then a bit later, right, in Babbage's machine, it suddenly clicks, goes into human beings, or whatever it is. So we've got the best of both worlds. We've got an originating God and so on. Meanwhile, back in elsewhere in the world, Darwin has not only thought of part of this species, the theory of species, but he then reads Chambers and absorbs all that and so on. So the link with Mendel's is that you've already got in Western thought this binary.
Good. That's what I was looking for. I wanted to find something that, you know, he could have in his mental equipment, which you wouldn't have in Chocolate Japan. God knows. I mean, but at least it's a possibility which wasn't there before this information came in. See.
And then it links back to some of our earlier discussions. I mean, we haven't talked about it at all, but behind all this is, you know, and this is where all this machinery becomes important, because the mentality of the whole of this, many of these things, is in a cosmology where machinery and machine-like objects and artifacts are dominating the whole world, so that although directly the science and so on may not affect the technologies, at the deeper level, both science and technology, I mean, you know all about this, Rob, the mechanization of the world, the analogies with the clock, the analogies with the machine, the statement by Watt that he may not have got his particular idea from Black, but he got the ideas of a world which was mechanical, which you could experiment with, which you did these kinds of work on. He got those ideas, he got the mentality from Black, even if he didn't get particular ideas. And so a world that is beginning to be filled with all those things, with glass, clocks, and so on, is a world where Mendel could exist. But why I think he would find it very difficult to actually in 18th century Japan was that it wasn't a world of the mechanization of nature, of the binary codes and all these sorts of things. There weren't jacquard looms and the rest of it.
Both of them were Japanese people, as we saw in the Scientific American a couple of months ago, who were fascinated by mathematical problems just for their own sake.
Oh yes, temple problems.
Paste them up in temples.
This
just
goes back to Smith and McCarmy in 1914.
This is it. Oh, it's very complicated. I mean, a lot of his stuff is wrong, and he got the Joby Swanjing wrong in that article too. But, nonetheless, it wasn't that there weren't people in Japan who would have been interested in the delights of the binary approach to the world, isn't it?
Yes, it was a demonstration art. It was like Kabuki or something, like you got up on the stage and you did solve mathematical problems and you're like touring solving them.
And challenging other people to solve yours.
There was a thing in Scientific American, wasn't there, about 2 months ago?
I didn't see that, but I read about Japanese maths long ago and the third invention of the calculus.
That's really interesting.
Yes, that's the one I was talking about. That's crazy. You know, can you solve it? Challenge the Americans to solve these Japanese.
That's interesting. I missed that.
Oh, yes, it's very, very nice indeed. A substitute for warfare, obviously. It was a really hard problem.
Where they made a few subjects in the school. We can answer that. So it's all the serious words in Chinese characters. They do pick up.
Tom, the cultural economics of the printing industry. In China, typically, when a book is printed,
Don't worry too much where they come from, just have good scholars or whatever. And they get wonderful concentration of French